go.
The recording quick draw McGraw. How about that? You already pre-selected all the links for me. Look at this. This is going to be so easy to do the show notes.
Well, you know, I try. And it's actually thanks to this Chrome plugin I've been using called Grab Y'all Links.
Seriously?
Yes.
Oh. Grab Y'all Links. I'm writing that down because that is not in the list of links. I don't see that here.
Nope.
But speaking of Grab Y'all Links, does that mean I should address you by saying, howdy, Rob Stenzinger? Or should I say, yo, sup, Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com?
Usually where I'm from, it's a squinty, slightly serious looking, but ever so slight nod.
Oh, is that it?
And okay. Silence. Yeah, that's the Minnesota greeting. Maybe the single finger wave.
Single finger wave? I am not familiar with this.
And that's not a euphemism for the... For the single deuce or the double deuce, it's
the double deuce.
It's actually typically while driving, and then just the one finger goes up,
like
exactly one finger. It's like a little one finger, your index finger popping up off the steering wheel, like it just woke up, or it senses a bird is hunting it or something.
And then you do like a windshield wiper thing with your finger, like
no waggle.
Okay,
no waggle. That's disapproving. Like, can't have a hint of waggle.
Okay, I'm learning something today. So just like a little kind of twitch of your finger, like hey, just,
yep.
This is new to me. We don't have this in Michigan. I wonder how localized this greeting is.
It may extend to Western Wisconsin.
Wow, fascinating. Well, there you go, folks. Travel and see America. You'll learn all of these idiomatic expressions. So that was a nugget of wisdom from Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com, and I happen to be Jersey Droz of comicsaregreat.com, and this is the Lean Into Artcast, the show about everything to do with visual storytelling.
We have the humble scope, exactly, of talking about any intersection between different art disciplines that strikes us at the time. and actually a heavy emphasis on visual storytelling, but that alone is a giant umbrella. But, you know, we do what we can and we bring in friends to help once in a while. We bring up, well, not on the podcast as much, but in the overall neighborhood, so to speak.
I'd be curious to hear what people think if we did explore the idea of having some guest panelists every once in a while. I know it's something we've stayed away from, and I haven't really discussed it with you, Rob, but I'm just tossing out there as a casual wondering. I wonder what would happen if, you know, would people be really that mad if I wasn't on an episode and I was replaced by somebody smarter and better looking? Would they really be angry about that?
I don't know, man. You are
that was not
in the intellectual tug of war without you pulling as anchor on these topics. I'd be just slopping through the mud like a sad water skier.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I see that happen every once in a while on other shows where, like, you know, one of the main hosts will be absent for an episode and then somebody else sits in for him. I see that happen a lot. And you know, what's funny is I usually don't get all that worked up about it, although I do enjoy it less usually. If it's not I want my old guy back, you know?
So, oh, yeah.
But it doesn't make me unsubscribe, but I'm not that kind of internet user, so.
You know, actually, we could try. Hmm. We need to get two dudes that have names that are similar.
You mean like when Dukes of Hazzard had Bo and Vance, or like, what was it, Vance and...
Coy and Vance.
Coy and Vance.
Yep.
We're the other cousins. Who just happened to be similarly proportioned and with the same hairstyles and hair colors. Wow, yes. What was that all about? I was just a kid, but I remember being like, what? Oh, no. Yeah, so it'd be like, Roy and Jerry.
It'd be Ron. It'd be Ron. Ron because every darn time I try to type Rob into my iOS device, it goes Ron.
Really?
As an autocorrect. And I just, It
will not learn your name.
Frustrating. Not yet. I mean, I think it happened after one of the updates, and maybe I just have to, you know, claim my name a few more times.
So maybe just needs a little bit more practice learning your name.
Practice, indeed.
Practicing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, that was forced.
That reminds me.
We'll get this one.
I wanted to double-decker that ham-fisted sandwich. No, yeah. That's a signature, man. Well, that's like, you know, that's the secret ingredient is the awkward transition into the topic.
the two very white, very polite guys awkwardly transitioning into something.
Exactly.
that's our brand. Yeah, we got to keep that. Mm-hmm. I think I saw an iTunes review that somebody gave us to that effect. So, you know, you brought this one to the table, Rob, and I'm curious about this, about knitting the idea of a practice and practicing. What does it mean when we say practice? You know, it's like, I need more practice doing this thing. Well, does that mean that you're going to set aside 10 minutes a day, 3 days a week to time to do my warm-up of, coloring? You know, I'm just going to color something. Is that what you're mm-hmm. talking about? Or what are you talking about when you say practicing?
I think it's a, it's a loaded term and yet super important and really useful, right? It's not like a term that gets really popular on the internet that all of a sudden people, you know, say get frustrated with, but which is kind of weird because it gets heavily used. But yeah, it does mean those different things. And I think there are, like we could ruminate on that a bit and, talk about our own personal, like things that we've modes that we try to use when we need to practice. Cause I know, like, for me, practice doesn't mean the same thing all the time when I am like, oh, I need to, freshen up on something I've been doing a long time versus I've never done that thing before versus, well, this other thing I haven't done before, but it's kind of related to this one thing that I've done before. So, in other words, some examples. So let's see, I've been working on this game development class, which we've been mentioning a few different podcasts.
Your white whale.
It is a bit of a white whale and whatever. I guess it's my way sometimes where I pick a creative project and I don't know what it is. Just I wrestle with it and end up getting beat up. But I enjoy eventually the learning process and whatnot and come up with something useful in the end. Mm. But anyway, it had been, let's see. So I chip away once in a while at the guitar fretter code, but that's written in Lua, you know, and then it's been a few years since I've done heavy duty game development day in, day out. Right. And I'll go through some anyway. So like coding and whatnot, it's like I needed to get freshen up my chops. And also, when I had been, you know, and I had fairly fresh chops, I was working in Flash games, actually. And it's been a few years, and well, now I'm looking at HTML5 games, right? So there's like these overlapping things that I'm pretty prepared for and not prepared for all at the same time.
Yeah.
And intermixed with that, working on or building another workshop, which it had been since, you know, November, really, since I'd fully authored from scratch a workshop.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And like, and getting, even if it's a skill set that you feel like is developed, getting back into it again can sometimes be a little bit of a clunky process, right?
Exactly. And then thinking about how all these things are kind of related to practice, where it's like, oh, if I had been, you know, chipping away at like, I've got a GitHub account and I'm doing little HTML5 experiments, you know, a few minutes a day. That would be, in some ways, that would prepare me more for some of the things I've been working on than just hitting it cold. And then I thought, well, am I fooling myself where I'm like, if I hit it certain things cold, I'm going to end up practicing and throwing stuff away anyway. And
True. When I hit things cold, I waste a lot of time making errors before I get into that rhythm of how to do the thing that needs to be done. You know, I'm trying to think of a case in point. You can keep going, Rob. I'm going to try to like dwell on this case in, a case in point where I know I was doing something where it took me twice as long because I had to screw it up like four times before I could do it right.
And then I've had it where, let's see, sometimes you can practice some. I've had it where I've practiced guitar on a regular basis, but then I need to write a drum part, right? And it's like, well, I'm not as prepared to do this thing. There's some related concerns as far as rhythm and feel of a song and all that kind of stuff. But then, I mean, it's a totally different instrument, and often sometimes in a radically different way. Where sometimes I'll program drums, or I'll do a combination of some things that are like programmed, as in not with code, but with putting little timed events on a timeline in a music application like GarageBand, or mm-hmm. or years ago like Cakewalk, which became Sonar.
Yeah, for those who haven't messed around with it, I know what you're talking about. You can like set on the timeline view in something like GarageBand, an electronic instrument, and you can set timed intervals of play the bass beat at this frame, and this frame, and then when you hit the play button, it'll have a certain kind of rhythm to it, right?
Yeah.
A linear visual way of looking at the way music works, but which is similar to when you look at sheet music, actually.
Totally.
So.
But those are very different things. So in other words, I'd have boned up, or I've become sharpened or capable on something, but it's not the right thing.
I know what you mean. You know, one of the things, you know, we talked in the last couple episodes about this comics project that I just finished, this freelance mm-hmm. gig. And one of the things that I did that I thought was, in retrospect, was a good approach, at least for that project that needed to be done really fast, was I did each stage as completely as possible up front. I did, you know, almost, I did all the penciling, and I was working on some of the inking while I was finishing up the pencils. But then I inked it. When I finished each page of inking, I pre-flatted it using those B-Pelt plugins, which I should write down so I can link to it because somebody's going to ask, what are B-Pelt plugins? every time I mention them, somebody's like, what are B-Pelt plugins? Yeah, I know. There's new listeners every time. Which is a good thing. That's a good problem to have.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would pre-flat them, but I didn't start coloring anything. Like I colored like the first two pages just to like test out the style that I wanted to work in, but I didn't start really diving in coloring in earnest until the whole book was inked and pre-flatted, right? So like the first third of the process was entirely focused on penciling and inking and then pre-flatting. The second, you know, two-thirds was coloring and lettering, and the lettering all came in one big go. So that by the time I had lettered my third page, I was in that mindset. You know, this is all I've been doing for 3 days is lettering. And normally I don't like to do that because I hate to be immersed in any one part of the process for too long. But you start talking about that kind of like that limberness, the flexibility and the getting into that rhythm of doing it so that you're not screwing it up six times before you get it right again. You know, undoing the rust in your joints, right?
And yeah, it's interesting that practice it's a funny thing. I can see why people it's almost like make really hard attached judgment calls and wave emphatic banners about practice in different directions, right? Saying you absolutely have to be super dedicated and you get your 10,000 hours or whatever. And I guess, well, that was a Malcolm Gladwell quote.
Yeah, that one gets thrown around a lot. Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell. So, do we need to say whether or not that's a fixed figure?
it's totally not.
Right, yeah.
Because there's the weird relationship of some activities, depending on the person even, could be totally preparing you for another activity. So I would bet you're warming up via your I bet there was a cumulative effect across your different practices when you were creating that comic jersey, where I would bet you were warming up, and not that you were that cold to begin with, but toward that specific kind of work product. Because I know like you kind of you set the project specific goals that weren't exactly what you had done exactly prior to that, right?
Right, right. Using more of a digital painting technique for the background specifically. And also, I wanted to approach the project, like a goal I set at the front end was, I've never really messed around with really wild color variations on a page for emotional expression in the story, right? So those were two goals that I set. We're going to play around with a new kind of coloring technique, and let's think about every page as being a color palette that has an emotional context to it. So, you know, I'm dealing in pretty basic emotions here. Fear, not fear, right? It's a superhero story. you know, it's like, okay, well, so look at the moments that you can punctuate with color, and what can you do with, like, you know, the scene should feel peaceful. What kind of color should you use in that? That kind of thing. So, yes, when I was penciling, and I'm penciling that page, and I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to put a background here because I'm going to let the color do the talking. I'm beginning to think about that coloring choice at the penciling stage, right? Mm-hmm. Moments like that did happen for sure. And when I was drawing backgrounds where there was like, here's a bank of computers, and I was looking at a lot of color reference from animation cells from 1987, and I was noticing, gosh, they're using wild color palettes. Like in this scene, Destro's standing in front of an orange bank of computers, but in the very next scene, he's standing in front of a purple bank of computers. What is up with that? And probably had a lot to do with the way animation was done back then, and you know, there's a whole lot of background plates that they just shift out for different scenes and whatever, but I thought, boy, how could I use that as a storytelling cue, right? And so when I'm drawing the computer banks, I'm like, I wonder if this scene should be a pink scene or a purple scene or a cool blue scene and so on. So yeah, that was happening at every stage of the game for sure. You know, it was preparing myself. I was warming up, as it were, in the thinking decisions I was making as I was penciling, knowing that this is where the color is going to do its work.
I am really just wondering this off the cuff, but I wonder if there's sort of practice situations that have that cumulative effect, and when it really fits versus when it doesn't. Well, because I could argue that maybe by having that guitar practice before needing to write the drum part, I was in the right mindset and prepared, because I was still concerned with rhythm, right? And and I was working toward an overall project and thinking about the role of the guitar and whatnot, and maybe not. And as it was a lot of times when I do brief songwriting of late, and it's they're really small songs, and there's a ton of experimenting going on. And so sometimes I end up figuring out the roles after the fact. Mm. So some of that wasn't as intentional, but you describing your process made me think that maybe some of the practice and when practice helps reinforce across different skills and whatnot, maybe that's a little bit of a systemic thing, which reminded me of, well, our design series too, where you ended up helping those different skills be more aligned by having design constraints and goals for what you were working on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I mean, also, I mean, don't you think part of this, I don't know for sure, but don't you think part of this could be that when I'm penciling, gosh, I've penciled a lot of comics pages. That's a battle that I feel like I'm comfortable fighting that battle, you know? I'm not saying that I win every time, but I'm comfortable getting into that ring. I've sparred enough to where it's like, well, I may lose this one, but at least I can, you know, walk in with a sense of confidence. Whereas with coloring, it's something where I'm not nearly as adept. I'd be much more shaky getting into the ring. So in other words, if I was provided a page of art to color, that would be a more difficult way to dive in. Whereas by conquering the beginning parts that I am more comfortable in, I'm sort of saying, well, let me put training wheels on the art here, or on the coloring here, by letting the penciling and inking handle what it needs to, and leaving room for the color to do the talking where I feel like I can really do it. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why, I mean, there's some things I don't practice that often anymore. And I don't celebrate that. If I had infinite time, I think I would practice them more.
Yeah.
Because I enjoy them a lot. Actually, namely, playing guitar is one thing that says when my schedule gets pretty booked, that's like the first thing that gets set aside.
Yeah.
And But at the same time, I've experienced the setting down of that skill and the picking it up again. And that's where I'm getting at this other aspect of practice, where maybe there's kind of like the secondary practices, the softer skill things that even the idea of, boy, this is a weird label for a skill, but setting down something and knowing what it costs for you to pick it back up again.
Yeah.
And, you know, planning ahead for that and making it work, whether that's a really low cost or if it's pretty high, at least you know what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And you go about it, which is describing two different things. It's that there's a discipline aspect of it too. Because like you wouldn't even see or manage it in that way unless you were thinking of it as something that should be managed and observed in that way.
Yeah.
I apologize if I'm spinning my wheels, but like these are the rusty nested Russian dolls in my brain.
I want to take a quick aside before I forget to bring this up. You know, this is something where no matter how creative you, however long you've been pursuing a creative, endeavor, a specific one, it can catch you off guard how when you see other people doing different creative things, it can look like magic. So years ago, I watched the documentary, A Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica. Do you remember this? came out like shortly after the Black Album. Is that right?
Okay, good. I think I've heard of it, but no, I haven't seen it.
I've seen
Cliff Amell, and I've seen some kind of monster.
Okay. I've not seen those. I was living with some Metallica fans at the time.
Cool.
And so I watched this documentary, and it's showing them building a song. And I didn't realize, not being a music aficionado, that they don't all just stand in the room together and play. I always thought that it was like, you know, the pictures you see from the 60s, like the band's in a studio together and they're all playing at the same time. And then the song is recorded and that's it. But no, they'll practice a little bit and then they're like, okay, do the drums. And then they record the drum track. Like, okay, do the bass. And then they record the bass track. And like, and they build this thing slowly. And then finally the vocalist comes in, does his part. And that seemed so magical to me that they were able to, like, how do you just do the drum track? You have to hear the other parts, don't you? You know, at least I can't separate it out like that in my brain. But I'm sure as he's sitting there playing the drums, he's hearing that. Well, I think they were actually playing like a demo track or something over his headphones or something. But in any case, I remember that really catching me off guard is that, oh, they build it one piece at a time, you know? Mm. And like, dude, that's what you do when you make comics, right?
Exactly. I was waiting to make that parallel, the comparison, because they do a sketch. Like you were saying, like sometimes musicians, and there's different methods basically, like they will have a different practice that they apply, mm-hmm. and whatever practice they use behind that to make them ready for it and all that kind of stuff. But like I think you described a couple of key common techniques that you have bands that jam and they discover songs, mm-hmm. and then you have bands that construct, and there's a few different ways where they'll construct, and a lot of times that involves a sketch where some subset of them form this core seed of the song, where it could be a drummer and a guitarist playing around and often recording themselves live, like a mini version of the jam, much like thumbnail sketches can take into account all sorts of concerns about the layout of a comic page and the flow and the storytelling and everything. And then they work off that sketch to get into more detail about specific parts like the penning and, you know, so, or detailed penciling, inking, right. et cetera.
Yeah. Like zooming in and zooming out again. Right. Like you start with like the initial,
yeah.
right. So like when I think of a story, it starts with, well, it's a story about this. And then I start to zoom in. Well, okay, what are the details of what the aboutness is? And then I zoom in a little bit more and I get into a thumbnail sketch, and then I zoom in more. Now we're going to focus on the pencils, and I'm going to focus on just this panel right now, right? Mm-hmm. And then I go to the inks, and like I'm zoomed in even tighter where it's like, now we're going to worry about line value. We're going to worry about how smooth these lines are. And I've already worried about composition and the story and everything. And now I got to think about color and how the color is going to operate between the pages. Zoom back out. We're zooming out again, you know? and then looking at the pages all next to each other. Does it feel cohesive? Does it feel whole? Yeah. So it's like a swoop. Creating is like a swoop. You start up high, you swoop down low, and then you swoop up high again.
I think so. And I have no idea, because this is definitely one of our, we have a topic, but what's emerging is our exploration of this topic. So
yeah, I want to get to some of these things on your list now that I look at it. All these links that you provided me.
Yeah, sure. It's some of this is just food for thought background, and not even all of it I have recently read, but you know, things like I want to by all means take a peek at that. I have an interesting summary that just based on what we've talked about so far.
Okay.
And because we're talking essentially about how practice and getting ready to do something has you prepared to do that thing, and then sort of like a creative project. And it's almost like we've described a method already that involves having some core intent. It's the aboutness of a project, the goals or whatever, right? That's the first part. And then we take out our different skills to start making it happen. And we're getting reacquainted, and we're discovering, it could be, am I ready to do this? Or it could be, have I picked the right skill, the way to tackle it, or whatever, coloring technique, or, you know, musical style, genre, or whatever, to accomplish my goal. And then you could kind of loop back and forth between those two steps. And when you're on the right track, then you start to get into the full production of it. Because like you described your comic creation process, that where you didn't go from purely one step at a time, here's the system of making the comic that you're familiar with. You knew that you would end up doing that and getting into a production mode. But on your way to that production mode, which is like the third step, the third phase or whatever it is, I don't know, you fully tested out an idea. So it's like you had the prototype widgets that you know, the two prototype pages that fell off the assembly line. You're like, oh, okay. Now you can make more decisions. You could go all the way back to the beginning and say, I need way more practice or what have you. Or for you, you just flex and you go, I did that in 5 minutes.
No.
And you throw down the brush, pump your fists.
No, you're right. That's exactly what I didn't have it that formulated when I did it. But yeah, to do two test pages of coloring, that was really to figure out, can I get through this whole book with this? Or do I need to throw this out and go back to what I'm more well-versed in for this project and do more practice on this painting technique, you know, later on? And as a matter of fact, if you look at, and the pages are online, they're on my Google Plus page, actually. You can look at my photo galleries there. The first page I did, I colored the mountain range in my old style because I was giving myself room to breathe. It's like, okay, one thing at a time, dude, just paint the distant objects with that painterly style, and let's render the foreground elements in the more cel-shaded style that you're used to.
How did you know to do that?
It was a situation where I was looking at the real estate of the page and saying that these foreground elements are eating up a lot of space. This is going to take a lot of time, given that I'm not proficient with this technique yet. So it was a time allocation issue, for one. Two was, God, this is going to sound dumb. I didn't immediately see the colors when I looked at the inked page. I don't know if it's like this for you. And think about music when you're making music, too. There are times when I can pre-visualize an image just by looking at the half-finished image. Like I can complete the image in my mind. And then when that happens, when I can do that, oh man, do those drawings sing. This is why 9 times out of 10, I'm really happy with my warm-up sketches, because I'm sticking to poses that are easy for me to do. They're poses I've done a bunch of times. I can complete the image after a few initial strokes of the pencil, right? But I was looking at that mountain range and I was saying, I don't know what color this needs to be. And rather than render it and find out that it's the wrong colors and the wrong rendering style, I want to save time, default to a method that I'm well versed in, and I can easily change around. I can easily adapt it by just saving some channels and whatnot. So it was, did that answer the question at all?
It sounds like part of it is being really familiar with what you needed to tackle and also familiar with your situation, like your, like where are you at with, it's like, okay, this is the battle I have ahead of me. This page has these challenges and I know I'm at a certain point with being ready to tackle all these different challenges. Yeah. And on purpose, you wanted to make some part of it actually harder or less familiar, by choosing something that is a little less familiar or what have you. But then, I'm trying to drive at. I love the meta, I guess, right? You know, and there's this lesser sung or somewhat unsung kind of practice that has to do with what that thought process is that you used. And it had to do with your experience. And so sometimes I think, well, we celebrate this kind of thing. We love it when people are mastering something and they demonstrate it, but then there's a lot of mystery and whatnot. And I think there's that this mystery doesn't have, is in part, a portion of it is this comfort with experience and context to be able to pull something off, but yet not overly frozen and dedicated like a robot saying, I practice this and this is how I do it every single time. There is no more variables. Yeah. I know all the variables, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there you go. You're demonstrating that thing. And maybe it has a name and I'm being silly, but
I, if there is a name, I don't know it, but yeah. The flexibility, I mean, a dumbed down way of saying it would be is that always trying to, like, treating every project like a learning experience as well as a thing to finish, right?
Because there's exactly, you had this pragmatic part of saying, like, this thing has a cost. It has to be, that has to be paid in the effort to get it done, but also in the time that you have to do it and all this, where you're balancing this out as you're moving along and finishing it. Mm-hmm. And there's where this is. So these are in some of these notes I cobbled together. I mean, I don't know. I was eating fish tacos over lunch and I just kind of cranked out some notes and whatever. They're not that scrutinized.
You're going to go in the penalty box in a second if you don't knock this off.
Oh God, I just disclaimed, didn't I? No single finger wave to me.
Nickel in the jar. All right. Yeah. So this list, which one were you going to point at based on this?
It's this, what I'm getting at with this like soft skill kind of thing where it's something to do with, or even the it's the later section talking about how like the hard skills and the soft skills really overlap. Right. So your ability to move that pencil in the right ways that express that and visualize the ideas that you have for the story you want to tell. You know, you have those skills, but you're also managing them behind the scenes, too, as you're executing because they don't stand alone and whatnot. So it's not like you're a monk only practicing this one thing. There's more to it than that. I don't know. So where I think a lot of times practice gets really celebrated in that monk-like fashion where there's the one thing and it's like, wow, that person can do that one thing and it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when I was talking about that movie Kung Fu Panda 2 when Tigress is like punching this wall so hard that like she's calloused her hands up that they're like super, super strong and she can't feel it anymore when you hit her palms, right? And so she's asking the panda, like, punch my palms or whatever. And he's doing that and she's like, he's punching super hard, but she can't feel it. And he says, like, well, how long does it take to get your paws to be like that? And she's like, 13 years or something like that. I forget the exact quote. You can go back to some earlier Leotard episodes to hear the exact quote or watch Kung Fu Panda 2. But my point is like, yeah, that is the version that gets glamorized, is that I've been doing this for X amount of years, and that guarantees me a certain proficiency to do this specific thing, right?
Yeah, where there's, if you have, I guess maybe, and here's where they do overlap. So let's say that specific thing is finishing things on time, mm-hmm. or let's say that specific thing is finishing it to your satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's as much of a skill.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Finding out what even that is, what your satisfaction means. Right.
Yes. And then holding yourself to it, but in a way that has the flexibility that's pragmatic, where if you're like, well, I have some tolerance levels, right? So if it's zero tolerance, then the shuttle never lifts off, right? But right. The risks are different with the shuttle than with the comic page, right?
Right. But yeah, you know, this reminds me of something that I noticed that changed when I started to get to know my work better as a creator. And I think it also comes out of maturity as well, possibly. Is there's the artist who goes, you know, they finish the thing and everybody's like, oh, good job. And they're like, oh, it's not right. You know, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And all they can see are the flaws. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed a change years ago that happened where I was like, you know what? All things considered, all variables put into the mix and carefully weighed, this is pretty good. You know, it's like, yeah, that's wrong, that's wrong, and that's wrong. But I'll beat those next time. As I am as an artist at this particular period of time, this is not too bad. And it's not that, you know, it's not that my self-esteem issues are taken care of or anything like that, but it's a, you have like a sort of a broader understanding of what it takes to make the thing, and you're not so entirely focused on that one error that you made, because mm-hmm. you in managing a project, you have to consider it as a large whole, like you were talking about, managing all those different aspects of it. So it makes you a little bit more compassionate about the errors, right?
Mm. Well, that's the other thing too, is like if you don't have... Let's see. I don't want to. How do I say this in a non-prescriptive way? I just have strong feelings on this idea, right?
Then say them. That's and people want to hear strong feelings.
Oh, let's see. Now I'm losing my train of thought because I started to question myself. Like, am I disclaiming? And I'm cursing myself. Let's see.
I want to warn everybody that we might disclaim something coming up in a second here because as you know, we're all very careful about the things that we say. Let's disclaim the disclaimer. Let's just make it an hour of constant apologies for saying
that's one way to do it. That's the model of that's a self punitive kind of thing. Like, you know, I'm gonna, you know, eat this this entire cake. So I just don't ever want cake again or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Locking yourself in the closet with a box of cigars, that old idea.
There, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay, you were going to say something and then I rudely led you astray by making fun.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to recover it as we talk because it poofed away.
Sorry.
No.
But anyway, you were going to point at something on the list that was talking about these hard skills and soft skills overlapping and being interrelated. And
yeah,
I'm
so
which one of these that you were
kind of the last section here. Similarities and overlap between the general and specific. So, as in thinking about like something that we were starting to get into that, where when you table something and you come back to it and knowing how to spin up again. I don't know why I think of spin up. Maybe that's a spinning plates thing, or that's a
hard drive spinning up.
Yeah, hard drive spinning up, exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's not quite ready to give me my data till it...
Oh, that's the worst. I'm so impatient. I'm totally one of those people who does like the hand gesture, like, come on, come on, come on, when I'm trying to get my computer to wake up from sleep.
SSDs, you know?
I know. I need to invest.
They're pretty awesome.
That's what I hear.
Yep. Both my workstations now have SSDs in them. And,
Solid-state drives.
Yep.
Okay.
Then I started to think about, a respect for the different kinds of practices and the different kinds of skills that they're tied to, where like likely there's some skills like have a huge learning curve where they're literally, you aren't doing it even though you're trying to do it for a ridiculously long time.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot of, I think, physical disciplines seem to be that way. And depending on, and I think it could be, you know, your whole human being, like how your mind, your body and how you relate to things, like for martial arts, for drawing, for...
Oh, man, you were so right. When I was taking martial arts classes years ago, and the first several weeks were just learning to fall down properly, you know, where it's like, I'm going to push you, and you're going to fall down. And I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? You know, and the first couple weeks of that, I was so uncomfortable with the aggressive act of being pushed, you know, that I kept falling down all clunky and hard. And then when I finally reset my mind to being like, this dude's trying to help me. This guy is trying to help me. He's pushing me, but this is to help teach me something.
Yeah.
And then when I stopped thinking of it as being this aggressive act, but thinking of it as being a learning act or a teaching act, suddenly I noticed that I was falling down better. So there's a definite connection there between like the way you perceive the situation and the way when you're building a skill, right? Like that, right? There's a difference between I got to knuckle down and I got to study hard tonight because the exam's tomorrow versus, oh man, I can't wait to find out this information. I can't wait to figure out how to do this thing. Oh, I can't wait to get home and crack open that book and figure this, you know, when I've learned a subject because I was super excited about it or, you know, was ready for it. Totally different experience than when I was doing it out of a sense of fear, a sense of penalty.
Mm-hmm. So, well, now you reminded me of, how you look at it. It matters a lot. That's why there's disciplines like gamification being wrapped up with learning and whatnot.
Yeah.
Which that's another thing that while I have done some consulting in that area and I've when you're making a game, you're doing some kind of gamification, period, no matter what, because you're trying to wrap some kind of set of interesting choices that have some built-in incentive and reward for that feels good to move through. And that whole feeling good to move through thing really does help a learning experience where, anyway, it's a pretty popular concept, no matter, I keep chewing on the word and expecting some other word to replace it because.
No, we'll just have to live with the fact that it's getting a bad rap right now because, like viral video, you know, some people out there have gotten their hands on it and they're misusing it, you know. But that doesn't make the fact that doesn't take away the meaning of what viral video ultimately means, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's true. There's a lot of misuse of it, but. Yeah, gamification, same kind of thing where you are trying to basically present a similar, provide similar experience, similar results, but through an overall different way to look at it, which yields a different experience. It's a lot like looking at that moment of this isn't some kind of negative pain someone is imposing on me. I'm, you know, in the martial arts context, I'm here to learn. And there's things that my body hasn't experienced that this person's trying to show me by causing my body to experience it.
Yeah.
There's just really not that many methods to do that.
Right.
Other than getting punched and shoved.
It's like, how else am I going to learn to fall down? Really, how many ways can you cut that one?
It involves gravity and hitting that floor at some point.
Yeah, and it involves somebody pushing me without me being ready for it so that I can learn to adapt my body to an unexpected situation. That's the whole purpose. So no, you're right. Not many ways to gamify that thing, unless you turn it into like a double dare obstacle course.
Arguably the belt system is one of is.
The belt system.
The belt system. So martial arts providing providing the celebration of arriving at certain milestones.
Oh, yeah. See, I never got belted. So I don't know how that is even done. I'm guessing that you just spar with the master for a while.
It depends on the martial art, actually. It very much depends. But and I think that... I did not make it that far or what have you. I'm not trying to overblow my, and I am disclaiming, so shame on me.
it's a tough skill to cut yourself some slack.
In some ways, it's tough. Here's the light and dark side of disclaiming. Context is useful.
Yes, it is.
But if I'm trying to do it in a way that's like I'm belittling myself because, you know, in other words, I'm not coming in to the audience as like, hey, we're peers and we're just talking about this. Yeah. I want to seem like the lesser to make you more comfortable. That sucks. So anyway.
Well, and here's another pill to swallow on this. This is how I've been thinking about it. This is totally off subject, but maybe people find this interesting, is that by not disclaiming what I'm trying to get out of it, here's where we always get at everything is a learning opportunity. It will hopefully make me a better public speaker because I'm going to have to be clearer about what I'm saying. I'm going to try to say things that are clear in their meaning without context, right? So that, obviously, that's not going to work with everything, but can I write and speak better so that I don't have to back up and say, not to say this, not to say that? How can I just say this, and you know it's not this and that? That's less ambiguity, I think, would be a good thing. So that's the positive benefit that we should be striving for, or at least I am.
Hear, hear. I agree. Yes. Clear communication.
thanks for summing up 20 minutes of me talking into that. God, you're so good at that.
It's easy because we're playing different roles in the conversation where when you are in the mode of you are creating and you are expressing, where I get to play the role of, oh, I observed and now I can edit, right?
Yeah. Huh? Observe and report. Yeah.
Observer. Exactly. It's the, yeah. I have the easy role in that situation.
But practicing. Yeah. You know, it's like, I think you're right. I think a lot of people have this picture in their head that the monk kind of thing. Also, I remember when I was in college and I'm, you know, hanging out with other kids and all these 20 somethings who are all learning about themselves and going through that period of, am I a Buddhist? Am I a Christian? Am I a whatever? And somebody asked, do you practice? You know, do you? And they were referring to a specific religion based on assumptions, based upon my appearance. And, you know, do you practice? Do you observe a weekly ritual of some sort? Because that's the only way to prove it.
Yeah, I guess in some ways practice is a signifier to a community also, where it's not just, well, you get over a certain hurdle behind the scenes and no one sees that, but you know you can do it. There's some things are yeah, it's a social proving mechanism too. I didn't even consider that angle.
Well, I think about when back, this would be, it's around the same time when I was going to college and I was experimenting with all sorts of different things. Don't read into that. But I was taking martial arts classes and, you know, playing around with things like meditation and so on. And I remember I was talking with somebody who was really into meditation. And then they said, well, are you know, in addition to your martial arts practice, are you doing meditation? And I said, well, I'm doing a thing where I walk alone at night every night for an hour, and I try to be mindful of my surroundings. I just try to look at things and notice things and don't think about stuff going on at home and, you know, practicing mindful consideration of, you know, the Japanese garden kind of thing. And they said, oh, well, that's not meditation. You know, meditation is sitting in the lightning bolt posture and breathing with your stomach and holding your back erect and, you know, and clearing your mind by keeping your eyes closed and focusing on your breathing. And I was young and stupid, and I was like, oh, really? Oh, I'm not doing it right? You know, but
I don't want to cut you off.
No, I was trying to pass it off to you. Like,
you are totally reminding me then of communities that are sort of practicing experts that, I mean, it could be of whatever skill that they are organizing around, but some of them are like very legitimately, really complex, and they need that kind of peer review and all that. So scientific communities, right?
Sure, yeah.
Intense academic communities to really represent the and carry on and evolve in a very stable way the core ideas around some very long-standing discipline, right? Like any of the arts, or like you don't just get to say like, oh, I'm a ballerina. You know, that's really hard.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that would be able to facilitate that you connecting with that skill and share observations and about your progress or not. And so in some ways, communities are just sort of that bragging right or the exclusion of like, well, we just want to keep certain people in and certain people out. Sometimes it's partially that, but it's to help sustain a discipline, an idea that they really want to serve.
Sure, sure.
And or it's a complex thing. Like I was thinking about. This is kind of related. So I've been doing more coding than I have been in a while, while working on this game development class and working on the class examples. And I kind of went through some phases, like you mentioned with your comic too, Jersey, with testing out ideas. So a couple months back, I had more time to put into it. And I sort of cobbled a rough sketch of a whole bunch of things that I thought, oh, okay, this works. I can tell Jersey, I can do this. I've proven this much of it. I managed enough of the risk. I'm like, yeah, this is cool. And then I went and added a whole bunch of other stuff and made it really hard again. But that's a separate point. So fast forwarding to now really honing and getting these things into, meaningful little chunks and useful examples for the class, cleaning them up. I'm coding more. And I noticed something that happens to me when I code more. This is in my head. And I don't know if I've really said this to anyone before, but like, I feel like I talk different.
Interesting.
Like if I'm coding more, it's almost like my brain is getting rewired a little bit as I'm spinning up and tapping into skills that I've practiced for many years and different kinds of programming, JavaScript, HTML, object-oriented programming, functional programming, different patterns for programming, sort of, thinking of like the model view controller paradigm and like, does this fit this class? Like, do I really want to try to find a way? No, I don't. So I'm like, I want to keep this simple and make sure. Anyway, so making all these trade-offs, getting deeper and deeper into this certain set of skills that don't always apply to my day-to-day. Anyway, and all of a sudden feeling like this, I don't know, some kind of transformation thing.
Oh, weird. Does Kate notice it?
I see, that would be the test right there.
Yeah.
And that's where I think I'm probably full of baloney on this, is that I think it's just like a perception thing.
Well, it could be an inner voice thing too, right? Because, I mean, we've always got that chatterbox going in our brains, and that voice could be changing, which is what you might be picking up on. I don't know, but that's fascinating. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like that when I'm working.
Yeah, and it's so anyway, I actually kind of like it where I go into that discipline, and then I'd like to step away from it. Because I really miss the more free-flowing visual communication, even though it's really... I'm a very intentional visual communicator as well. And anyway, but it's interesting how I think different practices can, I don't know, affect my outlook. So it seems.
I'm going to try to be more mindful about that when I'm doing stuff in the rest of this year. Cause I can't offhand remember any kind of like really, I mean, there's plenty of emotional shifts that happen when I'm creating something, but, in terms of the way I think about things, I'm gonna keep my eye open for that, especially when I'm writing, because I think writing, when I'm actually thumbnailing a story, that's probably the most intense and taxing part of the whole process for me. And if any transformation is occurring, it's happening there. But
mm-hmm.
next book I work on, I'll keep my eye out for that. I'd love to hear from any of the listeners. Who, if you guys, if you can, if is Rob, here we go. Here's something we've talked about in the past, the two tip jars, right? The tip jar with version A and version B. I was just at the coffee shop recently. I went to Starbucks, folks, because I had to. I left my coffee at home. And they had the tip jars, and one said Facebook IPO, and then the other one said local co-op or something like that. It being Ann Arbor, you can guess which one was more full. But But anyway, it's going back to that idea. Is Rob crazy? Or do you think there's some, you know, that he might be onto something, that your brain actually gets rewired when you're doing different tasks? Check a box. And hey, you could tip us.
Totally.
We'll take it. I'm not too proud. But that's leanintoart@gmail.com, right? Yeah. Leanintoart@gmail.com. You had a lot of stuff on here that we didn't talk about. Muscle memory, rehearsal, procedural memory.
So I'm thinking, yeah, well, I don't think we have to like divide it up into anything. We could just, what are these sounds interesting to you to chew on?
Well, you know, I'm wondering what the word rehearsal has to do with something like visual art. I mean, I get what rehearsal is in theater and in music, mm-hmm. right?
Well, I think it depends on the skill. So, for instance, I would say visual art has a softer curve. Okay. I think it has a very difficult curve. I think it gets steep. So if imagining difficulty as sort of on an XY axis, right, where effort to improve is the axis pointing up, and then the I guess in your effort over, you know, it's the effort to improve and then your improvement, I guess your current level, right?
Okay.
Is the other axis. And then it would go up slowly, but it would start above zero, right? Because as long as you can touch that pencil to paper, you're doing it,
yep.
On some level. So it's above zero. It may not be high, or I don't know what the scale of the system is, right? But, and then over time, there is at least a gentle climbing to when you're able to do, and then now you'd have to start to define what's technically challenging to draw. And you probably have to overcome issues of how do you perceive light? How do you perceive the shapes and the values of things and their relationship and how they affect one another in an environment. And so you're starting to deal with other skills that or other aspects of this rapping skill, right? Anyway, that allow you to then improve. And then so you're measuring something that's improving technical over time that we're okay. Sorry for the wandering off there a little bit, but to contrast that with juggling, your chances are you pick up three juggling balls, you're not above zero. You're at zero and you're going to chuck them and drop them. You aren't juggling yet. Or there's a lot of other things like that you would need to work on in a safe mock environment. So a lot of the martial arts skills, the, you know, like the physically difficult things to pick up, that you have to somehow build a lot of like mental and physical, mental. That's cool. which I'm clearly running low on mental change here in my tip jar. Anyway, there's some of the or being a ballerina or whatnot, there's just some of these things have a high cost to get spun up and to be able to work at it. Whereas someone who has been a ballerina for, you know, a decade or whatever, probably could step away for a little bit and then step back much faster than someone who hasn't. So even those really hard skills for someone who became really skilled at it, they're more like soft, the gentle curve skills. I'm seeing a lot of scowls and
no, I'm puzzling. I'm trying to puzzle out a summary statement based on what you're saying, but I'm coming up short. Yeah. Like, is a way to think about it. Rehearsal comes before a performance. Rehearsal is something you do many, many times, right? There's the dress rehearsal, but then there's practice rehearsals, right? And all of this is, if you think about theater performance, right? It's making sure you have the lines memorized. Am I using the correct intonation? Should I try a little higher, a little lower? Should I, you know, do a little faster, a little slower? You're sussing it all out. This is the thumbnailing stage, right? Mm-hmm. And then dress rehearsal happens, and then there's the performance. The performance is you executing all of those decisions. But the thing
and the dress rehearsal for your comic is that's the first two pages that you did. That's the prototype. So dress rehearsal is the prototype.
Oh, okay. Now it's starting to click for me. I was trying to get at where, at what point in the process are we switching from rehearsal to performance, right? Because performance was the moment I committed to the look and started building those pages, right? It's just, it's a much more slower frame rate performance than an actual, but you know, I guess the analogy holds. I'm over laboring this, trying to construct this analogy, but I'm just thinking about like the old expression, when the dancer becomes the dance and the muscle memory kicks in and the performance happens effortlessly, and then the artist disappears into the performance. But that does happen in visual arts too. Going back to something I said earlier, when you asked me why I decided to color that mountain range in a different visual style, because I couldn't see it, right? I hadn't disappeared into the work yet. And when I disappear into the work is when I see it all happening on the page. I can pre-visualize it just by looking at the page. And then all the stories about Jack Kirby, not even starting with a thumbnail sketch, but just start drawing in the upper right-hand corner and just go to final pencils like a scanner, just moving across the page. Supposedly that's how he worked. It was in the biography by Mark Evanier that everybody should read if they care about comics. Kirby, King of Comics. And I'll put it in the show notes. But anyway,
you ever use one of those, you reminded me of that kind of, what is it? It sort of amplifies your pencil strokes. It's this crazy contraption where on one hand you have a stylus and you're doing some kind, you're tracing a drawing that is with a plastic stylus. And then there's this crazy interlocking set of arms that looks like you could connect it to the cartoon punching glove kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's an expanding set of arms and you're drawing with it. And on the other end of that crazy contraption is a pencil that's drawing larger than your little stylus movements. Anyway,
no
that's
way.
I don't know.
This is a real thing?
This is a real thing. Well, now I want to know what it's called.
Yeah.
Google it. Anyway, I somehow pictured, I don't know, Kirby doing that, but yet it was like printing out a page dot matrix style. Anyway.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? We didn't hit everything on your list, but we've got fodder for another discussion. We're at the top of the hour, and that was a fun mental exercise trying to wrap our brains around a few difficult concepts. My favorite episodes are the ones where we kind of stop and go, you know, I don't even know what I think about this yet. Let's puzzle it out. Because, you know, like one of the recurring themes in this episode is that every project presents itself with an opportunity to learn something new. And if I'm not learning something new with each new thing, then all I'm doing is repeating myself. And that is boring. So.
Exactly. And I think there's, as you're thinking about your process, there's a lot of kinds of practice and skills that are worth celebrating and noticing and coming up with your own intentional approach to managing them. Right.
Yeah. I didn't even realize until you pointed it out that I was doing project management while I was figuring out how to color that page. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was because I was considering using that painterly style on the characters themselves as well. And in those two initial test pages, I realized A, I don't need to, because they look even more vibrant against this painted background, but B, that's another time allocation thing, resource allocation that I have to consider in order to make this deadline. So, yeah.
And I just wanted to mention one of the, obviously by working on this game development class, I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to tackle the practice topic, and I know we're wrapping up. But one of I started listening to a podcast that I hadn't checked out before, and it's called The Lost Cast. And it's by the guys who made this game company called Lost Decade Games. And it's a really good show if you're into learning about game development or HTML5 game development specifically, because they've had some really good success in that arena. And hearing them recount some of their history and how they've gone through learning their craft and getting consistent at shipping and getting things and And I really identified with some of the things. They basically mentioned, you know, certain traps and things that I've fallen into before with the with game development and coding and perfectionism and whatnot. And it's a very interesting thing where, like, you can stay in a mode where you're worshiping that practice, that specific, I got to code this thing better. Or now someone moved my, you know, cheese.
Yeah.
I was hesitating on
he
that.
He said
one.
It. He said it.
I said it. And I mean it in a derogatory way. So there you go. Someone moved my cheese because now the technology changed and how do I finish my whatever? And that'd be the same thing as someone saying, oh, there's a new Pentel brush pen that I really want to use. And now I got to redo all my pages. I mean, that's just silly where even when you have that somehow experience informed perspective, all of a sudden this natural project management practice is happening. Yeah. And it's kind of cool. A lot of interesting examples that I identified with in that podcast.
I'm looking in iTunes for the Lost Decade Games Lost Cast. There it is. Yep.
Which sounds like it's about the show Lost.
That's
but
what I initially thought when you said that. I'm subscribing now. Get the
yeah.
And I knew it was the right one when I saw the HTML5 logo with headphones on.
Yeah.
I will check that out.
They've got the game Onslaught Arena, which is, I think it's free in for iPad. And it's also in the Google Chrome web store. And right. So it's kind of like Smash TV.
Love that game.
Yeah.
I've played the heck out of that game. I mean, what's the point of the game? Run around and shoot everything. Collect the power-ups to get different guns.
Yeah. Exactly. It's got that wonderful fun loop of Robotron, but with a cool theme, a neat theme wrapped around it.
Basically the Running Man movie, right? With Arnold Schwarzenegger. But with meets Robotron. Oh man. Yeah. That was such a grim game. It was like totally like hot on the heels of like movies like RoboCop and Running Man, where it predicted a future that was like just disgusting depravity mixed with the faux gloss of commercialism, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Very flamboyant exploitation and celebrating that.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a weird game for me to get so hooked on, but I did love it. I loved the control method.
Exactly. There you go. Well, at some point we'll be talking more about games, right?
Yeah.
And because the theme, it has it some interest and whatnot, and that was probably one of the things that attracted you to the cabinet. But like you hear the dude, like I cannot remember the music for it offhand, but you have the guy going, he actually quoted RoboCop, like I buy that for a dollar, right? Mm-hmm.
I believe so.
Yeah. And
good luck. You'll need it.
Good luck. Yep. And that would be definitely Running Man, right?
Oh, maybe. Then there was also Big Money, Big Prizes. I love it. And it showed like the smiling game show host with like two women in bikinis standing next to prizes.
Exactly. It's dystopian future with a lot of explosions. And it's perfectly targeted for the teen of that era.
Yeah, yeah. I was a teenager at that time, so it was very much, it spoke to my wiring. But yes, we do need to do a gamification and gaming episode. People liked it when we talked about Metroid before.
Cool.
So speaking of people liking what we talk about, if you found this discussion useful, interesting, or at least compelling, a great way to thank us would be to go to iTunes and give the, or you don't have to go into iTunes. You can go on the web, I believe, and look up the show listing on iTunes. Just look for Lean Into Art iTunes, and it should pull up our iTunes page. I don't know if you can do a rating within that page. Or if you actually have to be in iTunes. I'm not sure.
You have to be actually in iTunes.
Oh, Apple. Lame.
I know. They have their system that they're trying to incent certain behavior. And it means that you've adopted iTunes to some level. That's what they want to do.
I don't know if you've infected me with some kind of bug, Rob, but I'm starting to get really impatient with people who do that kind of behavior. I installed a mobile app over the weekend called Mobly, because I was reading about it on some tech blogs, and it sounded like it was this weird kind of convergence of Instagram and Viddy, which I was like, wow. So it's like it has all the same properties where I can share video or photos, and I can push it to Facebook and Twitter and everything. Neat. I'll try it out. Well, I push an image to Twitter, and then I check the link to make sure it's viewing properly, or just to see what the image, how the image displays after being shared with this app. And it says, and I was looking at it through my Twitter client, and it says, oh, you have to be logged into Mobly to see this image, or you can view it in the Mobly app. Do you want to get it from the iTunes store? And I was like, deleted. You are instantly deleted, because I just wanted to share a dumb picture. Don't. And I figured they were going to advertise for themselves. I figured there'd be like some kind of like Chiron on the bottom that says like, this photo was shared with Mobly. Do you want to get Mobly? Fine. Let them see the picture. Don't prevent them. Don't put up a roadblock that says you can't even enjoy a stupid photo that he could have just shared through TwitPic unless you download our application. Oh, I've got no patience for that anymore. I got no time for them. And I blame you, Rob. The next thing I know, I'm going to be working on a Linux machine.
Yep, it could happen. It could happen. All I gotta say is, you know, there's people got to eat. They need a paycheck.
But don't make it impossible for me to use your application, right? I get it that there's an arms race going on in photo sharing. I totally get that. But you're not going to win it by saying, hey, you can't even look at Jersey's compelling photo of a Tauntaun unless you get our application, right? That's just
good. Here's the irony in that, too. Like, there's two levels of that. People got to eat. They need a paycheck. I was trying to play devil's advocate, but I think I actually might be I'm advocating your point, actually, where – so it's easy to think of the lame approaches to try to trap the audience – versus trying to really understand what they need and think of ways to make things systemically better in ways that meet a business's goals and the user goals.
Yep.
It just takes more effort. I mean, it's doable, but that's a more complicated problem where it's easier to think, well, if I trap them like AOL, then look what I got.
Hey, it worked for Apple, right?
Exactly. Worked for Facebook.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll save more of that for a future episode. If anybody wants to hear more about our thoughts on that kind of stuff, they can listen.
We prototyped about four different episodes.
Yeah, we did. Okay, well, hey, everybody, thanks for downloading and listening. And thanks for those who have given us a shout out on iTunes. We appreciate it. The only reason I bring it up is not because I think iTunes is so awesome, but just because that's the number one way people find podcasts. When people find podcasts, they do searches, they look on iTunes. It's a great way to let other people know about our show without you actually having to go onto the internet saying, hey, I'm listening to a thing. Just give us a star review. You're giving us another little bump up the ranks. Mm. So,
hey, Jersey.
Yeah.
I got one more thing to tease.
What?
I really want us to do an episode where we revisit some of the different questions that people have been posting to us and through the different mediums, anything from like we do have like a Google voicemail, and we've got obviously the Lean Into Art account at, you know, Gmail, and we've got the contact form. Anyway, people have been reaching out. That's super cool. Thank you very much for doing that. We love hearing your anything from the kind words to like, you know, super interesting questions, which we have done one episode based on.
We have
like one of those super interesting questions. And I actually do have a follow-up in my email right now that I haven't delved into, but it's from my wife, Kate Shields-Denzinger, that's following up on a question that people were asking about useful resources for early childhood reading and storytelling. So anyway, just to tease that a bit, you know, like we're gonna delve into those things and, you know, follow up.
Super cool. Yes. Follow-up episode will be coming up soon. We need to do that. Okay. Well, thank you, Rob, for the awesome talk. And thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. Until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com, leanintoart.com, and Jersey on Twitter.
I've been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and interactive-storyteller.com. And, of course, Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
And of course, okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.